Okay, is everybody back? Okay, good. All right, so welcome again to the Clean Network teleconference. Today we're going to have a presentation by Mark McCaffrey, but before we move on to that, I first wanted to ask, are there any announcements?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Bonnie, did you want to go ahead and announce for, NASA Innovations in Climate Education has an approved name change, and it will be ESTEEM, Earth Science, Technology, and Energy Education for MUREP. And we were asked to change that based on input from headquarters to incorporate MUREP. So that's one name change.
Okay.
And then because of that name change, we will be renaming the Ask Nice series. And the name we're currently planning to use is NASA 3E, which is NASA STEAM Earth Education. So that's our three E's. So they're the new names
STEAM.
We're tossing around. Mm-hmm. It's a STEAM is our new name.
Earth Education.
Right.
Okay.
And that
Great.
Will replace Ask Nice since we're no longer nice.
Well,
I know.
Maybe small letter nice.
That's right. Well, it's just a funny play on words. But
yes.
Most of all of that, I want to confirm that the date for the first NASA 3E, formerly Ask Nice, is October 20th. So if you could pencil that in, I will be at GSA in Canada. And Tamara, I believe you'll be there as well, right?
Yes, I will be there.
Yes, so we'll talk further about what we might do. But anyone who's going to GSA, I will be broadcasting this session from GSA. So we'll talk on future telecons. I don't want to take up Mark's time, but just pencil in, kind of save the date for October 20th, and we'll talk more later. Thank you.
Okay, great. The other thing that I wanted to let everybody know is that the NAAAE meeting is at the beginning of October, and we are collecting the names of the titles, presenters, time, place, and location of all the presentations so that we can, of the Clean Network presentations, so that we can make the one-page flyer to distribute and be able to attract people to come to our sessions. So I've sent out an email. I'll send out another one in a few days as a reminder, but please send that information to me and Sarah Hill, and we'll get that put together and get that sent off to the people attending that meeting. Are there any other announcements? Okay, great. So we'll move on to our presentation. Today we have Mark McCaffrey from the National Center for Science Education. And Mark, as you know, is a co-founder of the Clean Network. He's also is a former co-PI of the Clean Project. So Mark's been involved for years. He was formerly at a series at the University of Colorado Boulder. And he has a new book, Climate Smart and Energy Wise, and he is going to give us an overview of that book. So, Mark, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Tamara. So I understand from Frank Niepold that the president is speaking at the United Nations right now, so I really appreciate you making this little webinar a priority. I will be giving versions of this webinar in the flesh, so to speak, at upcoming NSTA regional meetings. The first one's coming up in mid-October in Richmond, Virginia, then all in Orlando, Florida in early November, and then Long Beach, California in early December. So I hope to see some of you at these regional NSTA meetings. But in any event, I really appreciate this opportunity to talk a little bit about the book and, more importantly, the content in the book. I'm not really promoting the book so much as the ideas that have been incorporated into it. I've been working on this book for the past couple of years, and I just wanted to tell a little story before I get started about how I've been thinking of this book in the past couple of weeks. I was approached by an editor about 2 years ago to write a book about climate change, and the editor was from Corwin Press, which specializes in books for high school and middle school science teachers in particular. Lynn Cherry has a book on Corwin Press that talks about some of the exciting programs out there relating to climate and energy. And I think this book is very complementary to Lynn's book. But I'm going to go ahead and mute the line if that's okay with folks.
Yeah.
So a couple weeks ago, I attended a meeting at Climate One, which is at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, to hear George Marshall talk about his new book. His new book is called Don't Even Think About It, Why Our Brains Are Wired to Ignore Climate Change. And in his presentation and in the book, which I've had a chance to read, he really focuses on how deep climate denial is in society, and not just the literal denial that we still run into from time to time. People who say climate change isn't happening, or it's actually warming, or it's overblown, but also the type of denial that we run into at dinner parties or in dealing with colleagues who perhaps are outside of the climate realm, who on some level are very uncomfortable talking about climate change. So 90% of the book, Don't Even Think About It, is about how really difficult it is to have an adult conversation about climate change in this country, even with people who accept that climate change is happening. And as George was talking, and as I read his book, I got to thinking a lot about how really heroic it is for us to be trying to make headway with climate change. Many years ago, I was influenced by a fellow named Joseph Campbell, who wrote a book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces that I read in college. And I don't know if some of you might be familiar with this book. Maybe you can raise your hand in the dashboard there if you're familiar with Joseph Campbell's work. But actually, his idea is that most all major traditions, cultural traditions, religious traditions, have stories that help shape society that relate to people's everyday challenges and how they rise above those challenges by essentially becoming heroic. And he has mapped out the different stages of this through the Greek tragedies and all the world's mythologies. And, you know, we see a lot of these stories in Don Quixote and the story of Joan of Arc. Certainly the Lord of the Rings is kind of the more recent classic example of heroes that go on a journey and encounter all sorts of challenges. And then, of course, these days we also see this in Hollywood. Hollywood has taken up this hero's journey and made a huge industry out of it. And we see that in some of the popular movies these days. And also we see that in movies from a few years back, like Groundhog Day, where the hero, in this particular instance, has to go through a lot of trials and tribulations to get it right. So I've been thinking about that in terms of our work around climate and energy, and I really feel more than ever that the people that teach about climate change and the young people who are learning about it are really, whether they know it or not, they're involved with a heroic journey to find ways to address climate change. And this is a challenge that is something that we all wrestle with, I think, on an individual basis, all of us on this call today. On some level, we're called to try to do everything we can to help young people deal with climate change. And certainly these young people in this picture here, this was taken 6 years ago in a kindergarten class. These young kids are now in sixth grade, and another 6 years from now in 2020, they'll be graduating from high school. 6 years after that, they may have families, careers. Some of them may be in higher education, teaching other people about climate change and how to deal with it. So the things that we do today are going to have a ripple effect on these people for many, many years to come. And so I would like to share with you today some of the thoughts that are captured in my book and on the blog postings that I've put together about the 8 chapters of the book. And in a way, this is a roadmap, but it's also on some level like a treasure map, because there are some incredible gems out there that we can take advantage of. A lot of this is sort of terra incognita that we've been trying to find the guidance and the resources to embark on this journey. But the way the authors of the foreword to my book, Jeannie Scott and Jay Labov, have put it, is that the book that I've put together is really a roadmap for teachers in particular to assist them in acquiring the background and also provide them with the resources to bring climate and energy education into the classroom. Certainly, science teachers is the primary audience here, but we're hopeful that it could appeal to a much greater audience, including other teachers outside of science. 1.6 million elementary school teachers, and as I'll convey in a couple minutes here, we feel that they're an integral part and part of the solution to the climate and energy literacy challenges that we face. So this is a very rough roadmap, and there are 8 chapters in the book, and each one of these is kind of a principle, if you will, that I will talk a little bit about this morning in terms of why these ideas relate to a strategy to improve climate and energy literacy in the nation. So the foreword and the introduction help set the stage, and the appendices, which include excerpts from the climate and literacy frameworks, are the foreword, introduction, and appendices and index are essentially the bookends for these 8 chapters of the book. The introduction talks about how we are on the verge of a new American revolution in learning, that the foundation is there, but we need to put the pieces of the puzzle together. So one of the goals of the book is to really try to highlight both the challenges and opportunities that we can build on. And this doesn't require completely starting from scratch, but we certainly do need to acknowledge that we have a long ways to go, that the state of climate and energy literacy in this country is very thin, to put it bluntly. And we don't have a lot of research on how young people know and what adults know about climate change. We certainly know that in terms of attitudes, people do take climate change relatively seriously, although it tends to be at the bottom of the list of things that they worry about. But John Krosnick's recent study showed that even in conservative states like Utah, almost 2/3 of the people believe that human activities have something to do with climate change. We are in the process of doing a study on teachers. This is a national survey that's going out in October of middle and high school science teachers to find out whether and where they teach climate change. So we hope to have results of that study coming up in early 2015. But meanwhile, one of the few studies that's really looked at people's understanding and knowledge of climate change are the 2 studies that Tony Lazarowicz did and his colleagues at Yale, the America's Knowledge of Climate Change study of adults, and then one on teenagers. And what they found is that only about 20% of teenagers feel that they are very well informed about climate and energy topics. Very few teens have ever had a formal course on the topic, and their attitudes about climate change are very likely the reflection of what Lazarowicz and colleagues called unorganized and sometimes contradictory fragments of information that they have absorbed. So in other words, most people's understanding of climate change is very sketchy. related to the study of adults, they found that using that Six Americas audience segment categorization, that the more alarmed people are, the more likely they are to pass a quiz on climate and energy topics. And the more disengaged or dismissive they are, the less likely that they are. But most people do fail. Most people get D's or F's, even among the alarmed. So that's an indication that we have a long ways to go in terms of building the knowledge and know-how to be able to make informed decisions. So that helps set the stage. And in the first chapter of the book, we focus on the nuts and bolts of climate and energy, Climate Energy 101. And we do emphasize the current research without getting into too much of the detail. Obviously, there's a lot of books that really do drill into the detail. But we emphasize the fact that according to research projections, we are headed towards a world where the forcing the what they call the RCP, the representative concentration pathway, is heading towards 8.5 watts per meter squared. Today, we are less than 3 watts per meter squared in terms of the amount of forcing on the climate system from human activities. And so if we continue the current trend, in other words, burning fossil fuels as if there was no tomorrow, we will be heading towards a world that will be substantially hotter, not just warmer, but hotter than today. And that is substantially a different world from what it is today, even with the changes that we're seeing today, a world where the amount of watts per meter squared has nearly tripled would be a very, very different world. So the difference between a world of 2.6 watts per meter squared, which would require us to basically radically transform society by reducing carbon emissions, and an 8.5 world is essentially a total transformation of our energy infrastructure. So again, continued emissions, a much, much hotter world than today. But if we're able to rapidly reduce emissions, we can have a world that will be a little bit warmer than today, but not substantially so. And this is a graph, I don't think many of you probably have seen this, of the radiative forcing as it continues out beyond the year 2100. So 2100, we're likely to hit 8.5 watts per meter squared, but by 2200, we could hit over 12 watts per meter squared. And that would be a world basically burning all the fossil fuels we're able to access, and the world would be much, much hotter than it is today. So how does that relate to the United States? This is the 8.5 scenario from the National Climate Assessment that came out in May, and this would be if we are able to rapidly reduce emissions. So Chapter 1 helps set the stage, and obviously the challenge is very daunting and very stark between those two scenarios. Clearly there's a lot of room in between the 2.6 and 8.5 watts per meter squared scenarios there. But what we need to do is clearly rise to the challenge. And one of the things that we can build on is the fact that we know much better today than we did a generation ago about how people learn. The chapter on teaching and learning about climate challenges and energy solutions starts with a little story about Carl Wieman, who I think a lot of you know. He's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist who is at the University of Colorado working for the NIST, which is the NOAA, or the Department of Commerce's National Institute for Standards and Technology. And Carl Wieman, after his Nobel Prize in physics, became very interested in physics education and developed the FET collection at the University of Colorado. And after that, he went on to work at the White House as the deputy science advisor to the president, working in the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And he became involved with helping develop the energy literacy principles. It was actually his idea to include in the energy literacy framework the guiding principle for teaching and learning. And these come from research from the national academies. And there's basically six essential principles or guiding principles that are included here. And for educators, these are kind of no-brainers, but I think if we recognize that these are key principles that we can build on, then in a sense it makes our job much easier. We can also build on the fact that we know, particularly around climate issues and to some extent energy issues as well, that it's vital to make these topics local, bring a human dimension to it so that it's not just dry and technical, make sure that these topics are pervasive. In other words, don't just talk about climate change as a two-day unit squeezed in between weather and plate tectonics or something like that. We need to make these topics taught throughout the curriculum, throughout the sciences. And we also need to bring a hopeful dimension to it because climate change in particular, as we saw from the 8.5 watts per meter squared scenario, is pretty grim and scary, frankly. The third chapter focuses on some of the standards, and I'm going to really take a few minutes today to emphasize how important these are. Where do climate and energy fit into the existing standards? And the simple answer is almost everywhere. Within the standards are important for a number of reasons, and in the beginning of the chapter I talk about the difference or the similarities between ISL 14000 and FESS 3-1. What do they have in common? They're both standards, and ISO 14000 is actually one of the international standards that helps organizations to minimize their environmental impact. Well, for ESS 3-1 is one of the next generation science standards that focuses on obtaining and combining information to describe energy and fuels and how they're derived from natural resources and their impact on the environment. So standards are important, and there's obviously been a lot of buzz about the Common Core standards in the past couple of years, the past several months in particular. They are a little bit controversial in some quarters because there's a big push for these Common Core math and language standards to be implemented in states that adopted them. Most states did adopt them as part of the Race to the Top competition several years ago, and now there's some pushback on them. But the basic ideas in Common Core are that if we have common standards between the states, that'll really help students when they graduate, but also if they move from one state to another, they'll be able to be learning more or less the same concepts in different states. There are language arts standards that relate to science and technology for the different grade levels. I will just give a couple of examples here of a couple of the math principles that relate to climate and energy. The first one has to do with making sense of problems and persevering in solving them. Another one focuses on looking for and making use of patterns and structure. And there's another one of the math principles that focuses on looking for and expressing regularity and repeated reasoning, so that if you notice calculations are repeated, you can look for shortcuts to be able to take advantage of that. So, for instance, if you know how much coal is in a particular coal car, then you can do the mathematics and calculate how much coal is going from, say, the Powder River Basin in Wyoming to some of the power stations in different parts of the country. And, or I guess they're also talking about shipping some of that coal to China by way of freight to Washington or Oregon, and then by boat to China. So you can do the mathematics on that and calculate how much coal that would be, and by extension, how much CO2 would be released into the atmosphere. But mostly I wanted to focus on the next generation science standards, and I will not go through all of them here, but in the book I focus on 46 of the 61 standards, and you may wonder why so many, because not that many standards relate specifically to climate, but many do relate to global change writ large. And by global change, I include climate change, but also other human impacts on the climate system, on the environmental system. And as we'll see in a minute, particularly at the elementary level, there are many important concepts that are covered during that during those early grades. And we need to really be thinking about how we can build a stronger foundation at the elementary level as it relates to climate, energy, and global change. The most radical part of the next generation science standards is that these standards are for all students, not just the students who happen to take an earth science class where they might learn about climate change, but all students need to learn about climate. All students need to learn about things that we can do to minimize human impacts on the environment. So just to cover some of these standards, particularly at the elementary level, in kindergarten, the students start to observe sunlight on the Earth's surfaces and be thinking about the Earth system in terms of how local weather conditions vary over different times of day, different times of year. In first grade, they start to observe the patterns of the sun, the moon, the stars, and to notice how over different times of the year, there's different amounts of daylight. So they're starting to be clued into seasonal change there. In second grade, they begin to observe how plants and animals depend on sunlight and water for their growth, and ultimately for their, they start to study reproduction and pollination of plants. Between kindergarten and second grade, there are some engineering design concepts in the next generation science standards that focus on how problems can be solved by developing new tools or objects. So that problem-solving concept is introduced very early on. Third grade, focusing on the Earth system and drilling a little bit more deeply into seasonal changes and different climate regions of the world. Also in third grade, looking at Earth and human activity, make a claim about the merit of a design solution that reduces the impacts of weather-related hazard. This picture here is of some people in Boulder, Colorado, coming up with a design solution after a flash flood last September. By the way, having lived in Boulder, it was no surprise that we had the storms that we saw in Boulder last year. It was anticipated that there would be, sooner or later, a huge flash flood on the order that we saw last year. What was really most remarkable is that the city, by and large, was quite prepared. They had anticipated that this would happen. They had invested in the infrastructure. They had built new bridges. They had built floodways. And they had prepared the community for the fact that sooner or later, we're going to get a big flash flood. And so that when it did happen, yes, there was some destruction and there were some lives lost. But by and large, the destruction was anticipated and minimized because they had thought it through in advance. In fourth grade, energy becomes a very, very big focus. And I think that's where we really have an opportunity to start planting seeds in terms of helping young people be thinking about where does our energy come from? How do we generate it? What are some of the impacts on society? What are some of the impacts on the environment? How is one form of energy converted to another? And also in fourth grade, there's a focus on obtaining and combining information that relate to energy and fuels and how they're derived from natural resources. Fifth grade, the focus on energy is more in terms of the food web and looking at ecosystems and how energy flows through ecosystems. So again, there's a major focus on biology and life science, even at these early grades. And we see that a study that I mentioned in the book from Horizon Research indicates that, unfortunately, many of the 1.6 million elementary school teachers don't have a background in science. They may teach it for a couple of hours a week. Often they don't do it on a regular basis. So it's squeezed in between the math and the reading and everything else that they're trying to cover. So we have a long ways to go to try to make sure that these concepts are covered in the elementary grades. And I think that even though climate change isn't really expressed or dealt with at the elementary level, there are so many of these important fundamental concepts that are covered at the elementary level that unfortunately are not being covered in general. And that influences what happens in middle school. Because if the students don't have the basic understanding, that sort of foundation when they come into middle school, the teacher ends up making assumptions about what students know or having to backtrack and try to cover these things that should have been covered in the primary grades. So in theory, at the middle school level, the students are really drilling into energy and the connection with matter at a much deeper level. They're looking at, in the life sciences, at the role of photosynthesis on the cycling of matter and the flow of energy through ecosystems. And topics like biogeochemical cycles can be touched on. Maybe at the middle school level, the details of photosynthesis aren't really drilled into, but the carbon cycle is introduced, and these other aspects of the food web, ecosystems, and the interactions of energy and matter are really covered to a deeper degree than elementary level, certainly. And then we also talk about the reason for the seasons. There's been some work done by folks at Project 2061 at AAAS that have found that this notion of the axial tilt being the reason for the seasons, when you introduce that at middle school, sometimes students really can't understand it until they get to high school when they have a better understanding of some of the geometry and physics involved there. But it is covered in the next generation science standards at the middle school level. And then again, the cycling of matter, the flow of energy, the hydrologic cycle, and also the human impacts on the environment. At the middle school level, students are asked to clarify evidence of the factors that have caused the rise in global temperatures. And so, again, this is where climate change starts to come in. The engineering principle asks students to take into account relevant scientific principles and potential impacts on people, natural environment that may limit potential solutions. And then at the high school level, there's an emphasis on calculating energy flow. In the biology class, photosynthesis is emphasized, although in talking to biology teachers, oftentimes photosynthesis might be one day out of an entire year. And there might be much more of a focus on, say, the Calvin cycle or something like that. which I think is really unfortunate because photosynthesis is really the driver of so much that happens on planet Earth, including the food web, including the capture of carbon from air that would result in carbohydrates that ultimately get transformed into fossil fuels and so forth. So we need to do a much better job of telling the story of the carbon cycle, including photosynthesis, rather than emphasizing these nuances of the Calvin cycle and so forth, which almost inevitably end up on the test. But are people, are young people understanding the basics of the carbon cycle when they are learning about this? So, again, in high school, we drill much deeper into the aspects of climate change and energy and design solutions that are asking students to break down complex problems into more manageable chunks that they can tackle one piece at a time rather than feeling completely overwhelmed. And then ultimately, they need to be contemplating how to evaluate the cost, the safety, and the risks involved. So that's an overview of the chapter on syncing with the standards. As I mentioned, 46 of the 61 standards in NGSS are covered in this chapter, and the bulk of them are 30 of 37 at the elementary level are covered. So again, I think that's an area that we need to have a lot more discussion, a lot more thought about, is how do we handle those foundational ideas at the elementary level. So the other chapters of the book include a chapter on energy, climate literacy first, walking through the seven essential principles of climate literacy, as well as the guiding principle for making informed climate decisions. And just as one example of what is covered in this chapter, the second essential principle focuses on the complex interactions of the climate system. And in each of these concepts, I focus on misconceptions, which would include naive concepts, misconceptions, misinformation, and so forth. And I try to give some examples of what those are and how they can be dealt with. I also point to ways of including mathematics in each of these concepts. And then I point to resources within the CLEAN collection. So rather than try to, you know, reconstitute some of the great work that has gone on in CLEAN, I point to specific resources, this one on energy flows from NEED, the National Energy Education Development Project, relates to that second principle of climate literacy. I also, in this chapter on climate literacy, focus on the greenhouse effect, which is largely missing from NGSS in terms of the physical mechanism of the greenhouse effect. Unfortunately, it was left out of the final version of the Next Generation Science Standards. But in this chapter, I do try to give a solid overview and point to some of the resources in CLEAN and elsewhere to try to help make sure that teachers have a solid understanding so that they can convey that to their students. You know, we've seen a lot of these type of charts. We've been trying to get NASA to finalize a visualization about the Earth's energy balance. The folks at JPL have been working on this for several years, and the visualization is still not complete. These type of charts, like I'm showing here, often do create as much confusion as they do help people understand the energy balance. There's just too many arrows going all sorts of different directions, and especially for somebody who's just being introduced to the concept of shortwave incoming radiation and long-wave outgoing radiation. So in the chapter, I try to deconstruct that a bit. The fifth chapter focuses on the energy literacy principles and helping unpack them. I think a lot of you are familiar with these. There's seven essential principles, just like there are seven in the climate literacy framework. And I do the same thing as in the climate literacy framework of focusing on misconceptions, some tips on doing the math, and then pointing to clean recommended resources. I also wanted to put a little plug in here for an upcoming energy education conference, which is going to happen January 26th in Crystal City, Virginia, just across the river from Washington, D.C. This will be the National Energy Education Summit, and it'll be the day before the Energy and Climate Change Conference that the National Council for Science and the Environment is holding. That conference begins probably on the evening of January 26th, but the summit on energy education starts Monday of January 26th. So I've been working with some of the organizers to have a special session on energy education that would include climate, and I know Tamara has a session planned at the Energy and Climate Change Conference that will be building on some of her past workshops and events. But if you can make it to the Energy Education Summit on Monday, the 26th of January, please join us. It should be a very interesting little summit and help set the stage for the conference, which starts the next day. Chapter 6 focuses on programs that work, and there are many, many of them. So these are programs outside of the classroom. So, for instance, the Alliance for Climate Education does go into schools and give high school assemblies that are very complementary to what happens in the classroom. I think a lot of you are familiar with ACE, and they're based here in Oakland, California, but they do work all across the country. I also highlight the Green Schools National Network, the Green Schools Alliance, and I profiled a summer institute that was held for middle school students at the Dawson Academy outside of Boulder, Colorado last year. It was a 2.5-week workshop for middle school students to learn about climate change. And I think it's a great model that, as a summer institute for students, can have a lot of potential for being customized by other students or for other students across the country. I also highlight the American College and University President's Climate Commitment, which is involving over 600 colleges and universities across the country. So there are many great programs out there that really complement and add depth and value to what's happening in the classrooms. And one of the key goals of these type of programs is that it can really add additional value to the work that we're focusing on in terms of helping young people be thinking about career pathways. The seventh chapter focuses on countering skepticism, doubt, and denial, and despair. And there are, as we've talked about on this and many other calls, there's a lot of research around how to deal with denial and skepticism, and what I focus on is how that relates to work in the classroom. So I provide some examples of different types of denial, because denial covers quite a spectrum. You know, it can include everything from literal denial that climate change isn't happening to more subtle denial, which is that I don't want to be thinking about it because it's just too depressing to think about. So teachers need to find the way that works for them and their students and their learners. Ultimately, we need to tell the truth about what's happening and what the science has to tell us, but we need to find ways of teaching these topics throughout the curriculum, because we just can't cover all these issues in a science class. We need to be talking about the challenges of climate and energy in the social studies class, in the civics class, in the mathematics class, and outside the classroom, obviously, as well. Emphasizing that there are new career pathways, there's going to be jobs in the future that don't even exist today, that can be a way to make it relevant for young people and get them excited so that they feel like there are things that they can do. And the final chapter focuses on what I call knowledge, know-how, and informed action. And the basic notion that I present in this final chapter is that we have the potential for transforming schools into living laboratories. And again, this is already happening. This isn't just pie in the sky. It's happening mostly on an ad hoc basis. And I do give some examples in this chapter of schools that are both fusing the literacy piece with the green schools infrastructure piece. The Center for Green Schools, which is part of the U.S. Green Building Council, has done a study of the status of schools in terms of their infrastructure in the United States, and they have found that we need to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in schools to bring them up to code, let alone to upgrade them to state-of-the-art. And some districts are able to pull that off. Some districts are able to get bond issues passed, but in other communities, that's a non-starter. And that's very unfortunate because that ends up fueling some of the inequities and inequalities between communities and between school districts. So we need to think long and hard about how to deal with some of these inequalities. But meanwhile, we can point to schools that have been able to really transform from the inside out. One of the examples I give is Casey Middle School in Boulder, Colorado. They were able to take advantage of a $200 million bond issue that was passed by the citizens of the community, and a portion of that went into all the schools around the district, but Casey had been built in 1920 and hadn't really been upgraded in many, many years, so it got a complete overhaul, and it is now really a state-of-the-art facility where students are able to give tours to visitors and to incoming students of the solar panels. They're able to talk about energy efficiency in the building. And, of course, all that really lends itself to being able to teach about those topics, talk about greenhouse gas emission reductions and so forth in the science and mathematics classes, in the social studies classes. So, again, just to circle back around to my heroes, the teachers and the students who are entering into this journey where they are trying to learn as best they can about the world around them, and they're trying to gain skills that will serve them in life. They are going to face many, many obstacles, some of them internal, you know, just being able to wrestle with their own emotional development, and some of them will be external as various factors come into play that make it difficult for them to be able to learn what they need to learn or to get the jobs that they could get. So I think that if this book is able to make some modest contribution towards that conversation, towards helping provide an initial roadmap, it will be a success. The book has gone on sale today. It's been available through pre-order, but it's available now today through your local online bookstore. And if you have any questions, feel free to contact me via email or visit my website. I've also put together a series of blogs about each of the chapters, which are available at ncse.com/blogs. So thank you very much, and I guess we probably have a few minutes if there's any questions.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mark. I actually did get online while you were talking, and it still says pre-order on Amazon. So I pre-ordered your book. Do you know, is it going to be available electronically or just paper?
Initially, they had told me that there was going to be an e-book, and then it turned out that that isn't going to happen. But I do have a PDF available if you'd prefer that.
Because I like to read my books electronically.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you can let me know offline, and I...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, are there any other questions? And Scott, if you could make sure you unmute all the Global Conference people.
Mm-hmm.
So are there any questions?
Question you already answered, because I read my books electronically as well, so I was hoping for that. So I'll contact you, Mark, and we'll just order a copy of the book as well. That way I can write it in and read it electronically.
Okay, great.
But I had a question. I noticed that you used the term misconceptions rather than misconceptions.
Yeah.
And I wanted to hear more about your reasoning on that. That was a really nice intentional change.
Yeah, I think that in the past, going back about 10 years ago, Susan Burr and I wrote a paper on misconceptions, and we got some feedback after writing that paper that in some cases, misconceptions can be a bit of a misnomer because on some level, it sounds like people don't understand something, and the research suggests that it's not just not understanding it, but in fact people can have multiple understandings of the same thing. So, for instance, you know, we understand that the sun doesn't really go around the earth, but our everyday experience is that and even our language talks about the sun rises and the sun sets as if it is going around the earth. So we can hold multiple ideas. You know, the correct one is that the Earth goes around the sun and it's spinning on its axis, but our everyday experience is that the sun is rising and setting. And similarly, you know, like with the Earth going around the sun and the reason for the seasons, I think there's often confusion around that because, again, we know better, but our everyday experience is that it seems like we're getting closer to the sun in the summer and further from the sun in the winter, which obviously is not the case. So some of the cognitive research has found that people can have multiple ideas at the same time, and that's part of the challenge of being able to address whether there are a true misconception or misinformation or just a concept that really hasn't fully stuck in the learner's mind. So I'm not sure that fully answers your question, but that was some of the reasoning there.
No, that completely answers my question, and I appreciate you explaining. When I saw that change, I thought, I know he has a reason behind this, and I'd like to understand that better. So thank you for providing those details.
You're welcome.
Are there any other questions?
Tamara, it's Scott here. I just wanted to really congratulate Mark on putting together what really looks like a brilliant book covering so many things that we've talked about for so many years, and it's great to have it in one place. And with his mastery of all of this material, I'm real excited that it's out there as of today. So congratulations, Mark.
Thank you, Scott.
Congratulations from all of us.
Appreciate that.
Yes, group applause. Woohoo!
We can all raise our hands.
Really helpful to have all of this.
So where else are you going to be giving talks on this, Mark?
The only ones I have lined up are at these regional NSTA meetings coming up in Richmond, Orlando, and Long Beach. But let me know. I'm happy to do more.
Okay. Very good. So we will have a recording of this, I believe, that will get posted on the Clean Network site, as well as I think Mark's going to be posting it elsewhere too. So if others you know are interested in hearing it, they'll be, you can point them in that direction.
Okay.
Okay, well thanks very much. We will talk again next week.
All righty.
Thanks again,
Mark. Bye.
Thank you.